Okay, so thank you very much for coming to my talk, which is titled Approaching Lattice Gate Theories with Tensor Networks, where I would like to present some results we have obtained by applying MPS to certain lattice gate models, and which range from real-time dynamics to overcoming design problem. So this was work done together with Marie-Camille Banyuls, Ignacy Sirac, and Eris Soa, also at MPQ, and in collaboration with high energy physicists, namely Christoph Tichy, Carl Janssen, and Hanna Saito, which was at that time at CCS Tsukuba. Okay, so first let's start very basic. What is lattice gate theory? Well, as the name suggests, it's the formulation of a gauge theory and a discretized space-time lattice. And this automatically provides a momentum cutoff due to the finite lattice spacing. And the major advantage of this approach is that it allows to go in the non-perturbative regime. So after one does a rotation to Euclidean space-time, one can interpret the partition function typically as a Boltzmann weight and then apply powerful Monte Carlo simulations, which have been used to compute mass spectra, phase diagrams, and many other phenomena. So for example, in the reference listed on in the lower right corner, you find this thing here, which is the mass spectrum of QCD, and the yellow blobs are used as input to set the overall scale and the quark masses, and then you can compute the mass spectrum, which are the blue dots here, and you see that there's essentially perfectly agreement with the experimental measured values. So in that sense, it's very successful, but if this would be the full story, we could stop here and would not have to continue, but there's also a major drawback with Monte Carlo simulations, namely the sign problem. So in certain parameter regimes, Monte Carlo simulations suffer from the sign problem, so this probability interpretation breaks down and one gets negative or complex probability weights. And a prominent example where this is occurring is QCD at finite chemical potentials. So what you see here is the phase diagram and the temperature baryon chemical potential plane. And you see this big question mark in the middle, which is a regime which cannot be accessed with Monte Carlo simulation and where the phase structure of the model is not clear yet. Another drawback of Monte Carlo simulations is that they, due to the way it's done, namely one does the Wick rotation to Euclidean time, one has no access to real-time dynamics, and one also does not get directly access to the wave function. So due to this drawbacks, there's of course an enduring search for alternative techniques, and a very promising technique on the long-term run might be quantum simulation, because this would not have any numerical problems, as one just tries to map the Hamiltonian under question to some experimentally controllable system, such as superconducting qubits or cold atoms in a lattice, then does some evolution and just measures the final state and then can learn something about the theory under question. And so the lower reference shows already a first experiment where this has been realized for 4 qubits for quantum electrodynamics. However, with this technique coming into reach, there are of course some questions, how useful are these quantum simulators? Because if you think of some atoms in an optical lattice and you want to map the electric field to the atoms, you typically have to map it to some internal degrees of freedom like fine structure or so on, and you only have finitely many of those, so you have to do some truncation. And also, despite the high level of experimental control we have nowadays, these systems are always suffering from some certain level of noise, and this noise might break in the end the gauge invariance. So it's not that clear a priori how useful a quantum simulator might be. And what can matrix product states now do for us? Well, matrix product states are somehow living in between. So what one can do is with fairly standard numerical techniques is compute ground states and low-lying excitations. One can to some extent, at least for short time scales, do some time evolution. And they are, of course, free from the sign problem because it's a different Hamiltonian technique. And these properties are very useful, on the one hand, to access lattice problems in parameter regime where the Monte Carlo approach would suffer from the sign problem and directly attack these theories. On the other hand, they are also very useful to benchmark and explore proposals for quantum simulators, as one can compute like spectra and so on and see how these truncation effects or noise terms would, for example, spoil adiabatic preparation protocols. And this is something I would like to talk about during the rest of my talk. So after giving this brief motivation, I would briefly introduce matrix product states and then mainly talk about two distinct models, the Schwinger model. And there I would like to focus on some work we have done exploring two different proposals for a quantum simulator, and only briefly mention some work we have done on the phase structure for the two-flavor case. And then after we have looked at this non-abelian theory, I'm going to talk about the simplest non-abelian gate theory with matter fields, namely a 1 plus one-dimensional SU2 lattice gate theory, where I would like to focus on dynamics of string breaking. And then, depending on how I'm doing with time, still talk a bit about a recent project where we try to find a more efficient formulation and try to integrate out the gate field. Okay, so what are matrix product states? As you all know, this is an ansatz for the wave function coming from quantum information theory, built in such a way that it fulfills the area law, so the entanglement entropy of a subsystem of length L is just given by or is proportional to its surface, which in one spatial dimension is just a constant. And throughout the talk, I'm always using MPF with open boundary conditions. And this ansatz for a system on the lattice with n sides is given by this formula here. So these IKs are a local basis of the Hilbert space on side K. And these IAK are tensors with three indices, which have one physical index ranging from one to the local dimension of the Hilbert space, and two virtual indices, which go from one to parameter D. So basically, after fixing the physical index, one just has a complex matrix. And as I said, I want open boundary conditions. So the first one should be... Sorry, did you say something?
No.
Okay. And was just reverb, sorry. And the first one should be a row vector, whereas the last one should be a column vector. So one has big product of matrices, which contracts to a scalar, and hence the name matrix product state. So for each combination of physical indices, one has this product of matrices. And the bond dimension D of the MPS limits the amount of entanglement. So from a computational point of view, this is very appealing because I only have to store a number of complex numbers in the computer if I want to do numerics, linear in system size and physical dimension and quadratic in bond dimension, as opposed to the exponential scaling of the Hilbert space. The question is then how large has the bond dimension be, well, how large must the bond dimension be that you can do something useful? Well, typically it is small. So from the first reference, we know that for local and gapped Hamiltonians, it's way smaller than exponential in system size. So the relevant corner of the Hilbert space are only the slightly entangled states. And also from our calculations and many other calculations on field theories with MPS, we know that also for these theories, the slightly entangled states are the relevant ones. And then with standard numerical methods, one can compute variational ground states or do some real-time evolution with this method. And that's what I would like to use for the rest of the talk to address certain questions for gauge theories. So the first gauge model I would like to address is the Schwinger model. So how does it look like? So first of all, we are of course always working with a Hamiltonian formulation because MPS is a Hamiltonian technique. And what we choose here for is the Kogut-Suskind Hamiltonian with staggered fermions and temporal gauge. For on a lattice with spacing A, coupling G, for F, capital F flavors of fermions. So the terms of the Hamiltonian here, the first one, this phi dagger L plus phi is the lattice analog of the kinetic energy and the coupling to the gauge field. Then we have this staggered mass term here, a chemical potential term, which is just the density term, and the electrostatic energy here. And additionally, due to the choice of gauge, we have an additional constraint for the physical states, which is Gauss law. So physical states have to be eigenstates of Gauss law, and which is expressed that they have to be eigenstates of these gauge transformation generators. And that's just the lattice analog of the Gauss law we all know. So that's basically the discrete version of the divergence of the electric field has to be equal to the charge distribution, and here the staggered charge, as you can see, is basically just given by the fermionic content here. And typically, so for all the rest for the Schwinger model, I choose these QNs to be zero, which means no external charges. So we're in the sector where no external charges appear. So for convenience and for doing the same procedure which is done in the lattice calculation, we use an adimensional formulation. So we basically divide everything by the prefactor of the electric field on the previous slide, and then the Hamiltonian looks like this. So then this x parameter appears, which is proportional to the inverse lattice spacing. Here's the dimensionless mass measured in the units of coupling, and the dimensionless chemical potential measured in also in the units of coupling. So the system we are dealing with essentially looks like this. So we have some fermions sitting on the sides, and in between there are the gauge links where these L plus operators and the L squared operators are acting on. And the even sides correspond to particles, whereas the odd sides correspond to antiparticles due to the staggered formulation we have used. So basically the staggered formulation means one separates the components of the Dirac spinner to different lattice sides, and hence one has also this staggered factor in front of the master. So for typically if one does a lattice calculation, one chooses the compact formulation. So these L plus operators are just the exponential of some angle theta, which is restricted from 0 to 2 pi. And from this commutation relation of the electric field operator and this angle, you can see that they are canonical conjugates. And hence, the L plus operator acts as a raising operator. And this L operator has eigenvalues, which are integer and ranging from minus infinity to plus infinity. And here you already see the first problem. If you would like to map this kind of Hamiltonian or to mimic this kind of Hamiltonian with cold atoms, then you would have to somehow mimic an infinite number of eigenvalues, which is in practice not possible. So one has to truncate at a certain point here. And this is like the next thing I would like to address. Namely, we have explored two different proposals of a quantum simulator for the Schwinger model case using matrix product states. And well, as I said, the challenge one is facing is that the electric field has an infinite amount of values, so it's unbounded even on the lattice, so one has to truncate. And the proposals we have explored are for the simplest case, so only a single flavor. And in the single flavor case, the chemical potential is kind of irrelevant because it's just a constant energy offset. So one can also set it to zero. And then there are, of course, some immediate questions. If you do some truncation to the electric field, the question is, how close are these truncated models to the real model? And well, writing down a Hamiltonian, which in some low energy effective limit mimics the gauge theory under question is one thing. But in the end, to be useful for quantum simulation, one has to have certain procedure to prepare the interacting vacuum. So a crucial question is how one can prepare the interacting vacuum. And a very, very crucial question is, well, if a real experiment suffers from noise that might break the gauge invariance, so how does this affect the final state obtained by the preparation procedure? Can we still learn something from a noisy evolution? And these are questions which can be directly addressed with MPS. So we have looked at this for two models. The first one is the compact QED model, which was proposed in this reference below. And what is done here is the link operators are replaced by something finite dimensional. Namely, one puts two bosonic species, A and B, there, whose total particle number is fixed to an even number in zero. And then the link operators are just the Schwinger representation for these two bosonic species. So we have these usual creation and annihilation operators for the two bosonic species, and the electric field is essentially given by the difference in occupation number of the two bosonic species. So what now happens is, if the fermion, which is sitting on the right-hand side, is hopping to the left-hand side, one boson of species B has to be converted in species A to obtain some gauge invariant state. And well, as one can immediately see, the Lockett-Hilbert space dimension of this model is finite. It's given by the number of bosons sitting on a link plus one. And another thing here is that this truncation does not spoil the gauge symmetry. So one has the same U1 symmetry as one has for the Schwinger model. Another model we explored was motivated by this reference here, which we call ZD model. So one might imagine that due to the truncation, the gauge symmetry also might be changed, and only in the limit where one goes to infinite dimensional links is restored again. And that's exactly what happens in this model. So the idea here is to use the angular momentum eigenstates for certain angular momentum j, or the eigenstates of the z component, to construct the link operators. So the link operators are just climbing up the ladder by one here, and the z component is of course diagonal in the spaces. And what we do is we identify phi j plus one with phi minus j, which means essentially if one is leaving the tower of states on the upper side, one is coming back from below. So if the fermion is sitting on the right-hand side and one occupies the upper level, the fermion is hopping to the left, and then one is going to minus j. And as I said, due to this type of truncation, the gauge symmetry is now different. So one has a symmetry only around, or one can only rotate around certain angles, which are integer multiples of 2 pi over d. And d is the dimension of the link and given by 2j plus 1, so simply the number of z components one can have. And then the limit d to infinity, this model also goes back to the Schwinger model. So summing this up, the original Schwinger model has a U1 gauge symmetry. However, the link dimension is infinite dimensional as the electric field is not bounded. And then these two models here have finite dimensional gauge links, where the CQD model has the same U1 symmetry as the Schwinger model. And this other model we call ZD model only allows gauge transformation with certain angles, but the linker is finite dimensional, and both of them go back to the original Schwinger model in the infinite link dimension limit. And as I said, one obvious question is, how close is this to the real thing? So what we did first, we did a spectral calculation in the following the idea of a lattice calculation. So in a lattice calculation, what one is typically doing, one is doing computations at different system sizes and different lattice spacings, which correspond to this x parameter, and then first extrapolates to the thermodynamic limit and then to the continuum limit. And with MPS, we can do variational ground state calculations and do something very similar. However, we have a different parameter here, namely the bond dimension. So we first have to estimate our truncation error, and then we can do the same as in a lattice calculation. So for a specific model, this looks like this. So if we look at a certain system size, truncation and lattice spacing, you can see our results in energy are nicely converging. So after we have done this extrapolation and estimated our final result, we can do the next extrapolation step. Namely, we extrapolate this energy density here to the thermodynamic limit. And then after we have obtained all these values, we can do a final extrapolation step to the we can look at the values we obtain and plot them as a function of lattice spacing. So what you can see in the lower left figure is, first of all, the exact Schwinger model, which is given by this gray line and the open symbols, and then the CQD model, which has the crosses, and the ZD model, which is depicted by the dots, and the truncation of the link Hilbert spaces is indicated by the color. So yellow means d equal 3, which is essentially the simplest non-trivial truncation one can have. So from electric field minus 1, 0 to 1, and the blue ones are d equal 9, which is the largest truncation we used, which is already quite a few electric field values. And as you can see by looking at the scale of the energy density, the deviation for both models is very small. And for the CQD model, one sees nice convergence. So if you take the final extrapolation step and extrapolate to the lattice spacing zero limit, we get this picture here. So the horizontal line once again indicates the exact Schwinger model, and one can nicely see that with increasing link dimension, the CQED model goes closer to the real thing, whereas the ZD model is already very good from the very beginning on, and there's hardly any improvement. So from that we know that these truncated models still somehow reflect some properties of the original models. But now a crucial question is, how can one prepare the ground state? Well, one idea we had is was starting from the strong coupling states, and the strong coupling limit one can means that the x parameter is zero, and one can easily solve the Hamiltonian analytically. So essentially what one wants here due to the staggered mass term is the odd sides all occupied and the even sides all empty, and zero electric field everywhere. And as one can easily check from looking at the electric field and the fermionic content, This is a gauge invariant state in the external charge zero subsector. Another idea would be to adiabatically ramp the value of x up to the desired lattice spacing xf during a total time t. And this is something MPS can do very easily. So one just takes this input state and then does a real-time evolution and simulates this adiabatic preparation protocol numerically. So we have done that. And so we have chosen this kind of ramp, so a third power in time. And I'm going to say something in a few slides why we have chosen this ramp. And as a success criterion, we just monitored the overlap with variational computed results and said the evolution has been successful if we have an overlap from at least 99%. And the results for this procedure for the two models are shown in these two pictures here. So the color once again encodes the truncation. So D equal 3 is yellow and is the simplest non-trivial truncation. And D equal 9 is depicted in blue. And the open symbols are for a system of size n equal 100. And the cross and dot are for n equal 50. As you can see, so at a threshold time around 60, we obtain an overlap which is much larger than 99%. And we can, with D equal 100, we are essentially perfect. And also, if you look at the relative deviation in the energy for both models, which is shown in the insets, you see that this evolution is successful. And while the error bars at the beginning we have are just due to the fact that we are not going slow enough, and then the evolution is not adiabatic, so we are, strictly speaking, quenching the system slightly, and then we have these error bars. And in the parameter regime we have studied, we also don't see any dependence on the system size. I would like to comment also on ramp. So someone has to think about the ramp, and also MPS are useful here. So what we have done to decide about how to ramp time, we have just completed.
Stefan?
Yeah?
Hello. Sorry, can you go back one slide? I have a question.
Yeah.
Sorry. I thought this was an important slide, but I missed what you are plotting. So T is the total time of the evolution.
Exactly. So to ramp. Final lattice spacing of 100, the smallest one we have used before.
Okay, so can you tell me again what the Hamilton, what is it that you're ramping?
So the lattice spacing essentially. So we start with x equals 0, which means a strong coupling regime. And then we want to go from the strong coupling regime to something with a finite x. So typically you need certain system sizes and certain values of lattice spacing to do this extrapolation procedure. And in the x equals 0 limit, I can solve the Hamiltonian analytically. So I can write down a product state, a starting state.
Right, so the starting state was a product state, and then...
Exactly. And then I slowly switch on this x parameter to go to x final 100.
And what does slow mean?
Well, slow means in that sense we are doing this kind of ramp here. So third power in time over total time capital T. And the reason for that is... What I showed in this slide is we have variationally computed the spectrum, so the grounds, the energy gap of the theory. And as you can see in the inset, especially at the very beginning, the energy gap is relatively small. So we said, okay, judging from that, I mean, it's very relatively independent of the system size and the truncation and the parameter regime we have studied. So we want something which is very small at the beginning. So if you think of this third power function, it's very flat at the beginning, and then later on it's becoming relatively fast.
I'm struggling to interpret all this information in real time. But in this plot, what you see is the x-axis is x, right?
Exactly.
Which is the parameter that you start having very large.
Pardon?
X is initially very large or very small?
Very small, zero.
Oh, I see.
Strong coupling regime means x equals zero.
Okay, that's where I was misunderstanding. Okay. So you're saying you have to start very slowly because the gap is very small when you start.
Exactly.
Okay.
So with an MPS calculation, one can basically look at the spectrum and use this to design a ramp which fits the opening of the gap. And the one we have chosen was this third power in time because we see that the gap at the beginning is opening very slowly.
Okay.
And then later on where it's already quite a bit open, we saw that it doesn't really matter if one goes faster. And then around the time of 60, we see that we basically perfectly recover the variational computed results. So the evolution in that sense is successful.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And well, then the crucial question is, what happens if you have noise in this preparation procedure? Because this might happen in an experiment, so we decided to simulate a noise model, and the noise model we have chosen is, so we are ramping this parameter x over time, so we want a noise with a relative strength lambda to this x parameter, if you think of turning up some field in the experiment or something. And then what we simulated, what can happen is that without the fermion hopping, the bosonic species or the content on the links can change. So basically in the CQD model, you can transfer a boson from species B to species A. And in the other one, you just go from one angular momentum state to the other one. And then we have taken the T equal 100 evolution, so which was the one which was successful and basically gave us perfect overlap. And we monitored the violation of Gauss law per particle. And the overlap with the real state, so the variationally computed state. So we have once again done that, and the results are here. So for both models, if we increase the relative noise strength lambda, we see what we expect, that the Gauss law violation per particle is quickly increasing, as you can see in the main plots. So the open symbols are again a large system of 100 sites, whereas the cross and dots are symbols of n equal 50. And now we have used the two link dimensions 3 and 5, which is encoded in the color as before. And well, the overlap, as you can see in the inset, and the left y-axis is also quickly going to zero because it's a global quantity. So that's kind of expected that this happens. However, if we look at the inset and the right y-axis, you see that the relative deviation epsilon from the true ground state energy is still very small, even if you admix noise in the evolution. So in that sense, this is very promising because it shows that certain observables might still be good even in the presence of gauge invariance breaking noise. And these quantum simulators still might give us results where we can learn something from. Okay, so this was the first project we have done. Another project I only briefly want to mention was that we computed the phase structure for two flavors at zero temperature. And this is interesting due to the fact, so if you now put two flavors and a non-vanishing isospin chemical potential, so this nu 2 and nu 1 should be such that they're not equal, then you're in a regime where you cannot access the problem anymore with Monte Carlo simulations in general because it suffers from the sine problem. For MPS, that's not really complicated. We can just do our ground state calculations. And what we have found here in these two references is that the model has been addressed analytically previously, but this is only possible in the massless case. So the massive case was unknown. And what these references found is that there's a number of phases characterized by the isospin number, which is nothing but the difference of fermions in flavor 1 minus difference of fermions in flavor 2. And the massive case has been unknown. So we have done this calculation and have basically computed the phase diagram here. And all what was known before was basically the y-axis, but with MPS, for us, it's not really complicated. We just compute the ground state for several masses, change the parameter, and we can really map out the entire phase diagram you see here. Okay, so now what I would like to do, I would like to switch gears a bit and come to an SU2 lattice gauge theory, which is probably the simplest non-trivial thing with dynamical fermions and non-abelian gauge group you can do. So what we have looked here is basically the same Hamiltonian, but now as of SU2 gauge theory, so it looks exactly the same. One has these hopping terms, which are the lattice analog of the kinetic energy, the staggered mass term, and now the Kalle electric energy. And Gauss law is essentially also the same, but now since we have a non-abelian group SU2, we have three generators, which are given by this formula here. So one can decompose the links in left and right electric field, and then this is the non-abelian analog of this difference between the electric field should be equal to the staggered charge, where the sigma alphas here are Pauli matrices. So essentially, it looks very much the same. So this Hamiltonian here is written on group space. So if you really write it out, what this really means is that you once again have the staggered formulation. So the Dirac indices have been separated, but on each side now two colors of fermions, so a red and a green one, are sitting. So this yellowish marked hopping term means nothing but that. So this U operator is a 2x2 matrix on color space and fundamental representation, and contains operators now acting on a physical Hilbert space. So if you really write it out, you get these four terms. And what this is now doing is, if you start on this state where on the left there's no fermions and a red and a green fermion on the right hand side, it gives you up to normalization superposition of these four terms with some finite color electric flux in between. Okay, so this is an interesting model because one can study string breaking in this model. And string breaking is a phenomenon which typically with Monte Carlo can only be studied statically. And therefore, one can do something interesting with MPS, because if one has the Hamiltonian, one can straightforwardly do real-time evolution and directly look at the real-time dynamics of the string breaking phenomenon. So the problem one faces, once again, is that in this original theory, the link Hilbert spaces are once again infinite dimensional, and one has to do some truncation. And the truncation procedure we have done is given in this reference. So the idea here is that these U matrices are nothing but Wigner matrices for spin 1/2, and thus allows to define left and right generators on the gauge links. And then one can choose a basis which is characterized by the overall angular momentum J and by the two Z components of this left and right electric field if one does this decomposition. And what has been shown in this reference, that one can write down these U operators as a sum over all the irreducible representation characterized by some value of J, and it's still gauge invariant if you truncate at a finite value J max. So one ends up with links then having this dimensionality, which, as you can see, grows fairly quickly. So even with the simplest non-trivial truncation at the J max of 1/2, so the only taking into account the trivial and the fundamental representation, you already have five-dimensional gauge links. And we have used this truncation to study now real-time dynamics of string breaking. So what are we doing? We are basically doing something which is very similar to what we have done for the Schwinger model. We once again use this Hamiltonian and go in the strong coupling limit. So we forget about this hopping term here. And then we can solve the Hamiltonian analytically, essentially in the same manner as we have done before. So the staggered mass term now wants also to fill up the odd sides, but the odd sides now are occupied by two species of fermion, namely always a red and a green one, and no color electric flux anywhere in the system. So as I would like to point out later, is an interesting parameter to look at is the charge square. Essentially, this is only given no matter on which component you look. So Q alpha is independently of alpha, always given by more or less the difference of red fermions minus green fermion square. And I'm going to say something in a minute why this is interesting here. So as one can see, this state is perfectly Gauss law fulfilling. And this is kind of a valid starting state. So on top of this state, to get an intuitive picture, what one can now do is one can apply the simplest non-trivial string operator, which is essentially just the hopping term of the Hamiltonian. And what happens now is that one gets this superposition of four states I have shown before. And what you can see here now is that the charge square at the end of the string has changed, because what this operator is basically does, it removes one fermion on side 5 and adds a fermion on side 4. So what we now have is two charges in the system connected by a color electric flux tube. And as you can see, the energy increase is 2m due to the both ends of the string operator. And then here some contribution given from the color electric flux. And you can also build longer string operators. So they're looking like this, if one would like to introduce a string of length L in the system. And the energy contribution due to the ends here of these phi operators is still 2m. But what one gets here now is some color electric energy, which is proportional to the length of the string. So what happens is, if you do this and make longer and longer strings, at a certain point, it's favorable in the system to create two new particles, so to pay another energy of 2n, and break the string in the middle and form two mesons in the system, and therefore shorten the string length, because then the overall energy is still lower. And this is the phenomenon of string breaking. So if we just put a large enough color flux string in our system, we expect it to break at a certain point, where the breaking point depends on how massive the fermions are. Exactly, and this is something we can do with MPS simulations. The only thing here is that typically how this is done in Monte Carlo, I've said, is one takes a Wilson static charges and then computes some correlation function like a Wilson loop or something, which is clearly not suitable for our case, because we want to do real-time dynamics, and the Wilson loop is some correlation function you typically compute in imaginary time. So this doesn't work very well for us. But of course, we have an MPS, so we directly have the wave function. We can just compute all kinds of local observables, among them the flux configuration or this charge square configuration, as I've shown, because at the beginning of the end of the string, we have these finite charges. And in the end, what we can also do is we can just construct projectors on a string state, having a string of length L starting at side N. And then we can create histograms of these string projectors. So what we basically do is we probe for all strings of a certain length in the system. And what we do here is we subtract the interacting vacuum configuration, because we want to see, with respect to the interacting vacuum where we have applied a string operator, which kind of strings do we find in the system. And as you can see on this graphic on the lower left, is that the number of strings of a certain length you can have depends on the length. So you can have a lot more shorter strings than longer strings. So what we do is, to get a useful histogram, we normalize by the number of strings of a certain length we can have. And then we can construct these kind of histograms. So the first thing we have probed here was kind of similar to what a Monte Carlo simulation would do. We computed the interacting vacuum variationally with MPS. And on top of that, we imposed a string between heavy external charges. So these charges are just sitting there and can be mimicked by having a Gauss law locally with a non-zero eigenvalue. And they have no kinetic energy because they are static, and the mass would just be a constant offset. So one can also forget about that. And then we can look at the real-time evolution of such a system and directly follow the dynamics. And this is shown here. So as I have said, we have done this for two different masses, m equal 3 and m equal 10. And the upper panel always shows the site-resolved color electric flux distribution as a function of real time. And the lower one shows this charge square, as I have introduced. So in the m equal 3 case, you can clearly see that in the beginning, we start with a high flux region of length 11. And over time, this high flux region is going down, and this color flux string we have put in the system is breaking. And you can also see nicely that in the charge square configurations at the beginning, there's essentially no charge in the string region. And then at a certain point, when the string starts breaking, you see that there's a red bump. So there are some charges produced. And these charges are then spreading and clustering around these two points where we put the external charges. And in the m equal 10 case, you see that there's essentially no string breaking happening, because in that time, in that case, forming these extra particles would be energetically too costly, and it's energetically favorable for the system to preserve the string state. So what we have done is we have stroboscopically taken images of the system. So this is shown here. The upper panels are for m equal 3, and the lower panels are for m equal 10. And what is depicted here is, in the upper line, always the charge square configuration. In the second line, the flux color flux configuration. And in the third line, the string histograms I talked about a few slides ago. And you can also see, so where they are taken is always at the beginning of the evolution, at the end of the evolution, and the two central panels, two panels in the middle, are given by these black lines. So one is shortly before the string breaking process, and one is taken shortly after the string breaking process. So as you can see, one first of all sees this production of charges in the breaking case for m equal 1, and simultaneously sees the color electric flux going away. And also in the string histogram panel with subtracted vacuum configuration, you see a clear peak around L equal 11, which is going away and shifted clearly towards shorter strings. Whereas in the non-breaking case, you see that it's essentially static over time.
Stefan?
Yeah?
I have a from Bangman's slide, please?
Yeah.
So you said you prepare the ground state. And then what do you do exactly to create this string?
So basically, I'm applying a string operator, but since I want to change from the charge zero subspace to two external charges, I'm not putting the fermionic operators at the end. This is basically going from one super selection sector to another one. So this the beginning process is somehow artificial. I create an interacting vacuum, then apply a long chain of diffuse to get some color electric flux, and then I violate Gauss law, which I can interpret as some external charges.
But you create the ground state in one particle sector, and then you on top of that you modify this ground state, and you change the charge sector. What did you change?
So first of all, okay, if we go back a few slides, if you look at the Hamiltonian here, the Gauss law has these Q alphas. So basically, I'm computing the ground state and the Q alpha always zero subsector for every lattice site. And then I'm applying an operator such that at the beginning of the string and at the end of the string, I get a finite Q alpha here. So we're doing it in the Y component because that's the simplest.
Okay.
And then we evolve that in real time with MPS.
By the original Hamiltonian.
Exactly, by the original Hamiltonian. So strictly speaking, I love the crunch.
Okay. Very good. And then when you show the histogram?
Yes.
So, are you evaluating the length of the strings throughout the system or near the region of interest?
No, all possible strings. So, all possible strings of length 1, which is system size minus 1, all possible strings of length 2, which, I mean, it's just a combinatorial problem. So, and then I sum all of them up. As I here, we sum over all system sizes for each length.
Okay, so and this particular result would depend on how large your system is. If your system was very, very large,
then the overall scale on the y-axis would be... No, it also doesn't depend because I divide by the number of strings of length L, right? So if you have a larger and larger system, then you have just more strings of length 1.
Right.
That's why we normalize here.
By the number of strings of that length. Okay, thank you.
Exactly. Okay, so as you can see in the M equal 3 case, we can clearly identify breaking, whereas in the M equal 10 case, well, and there's essentially everything static. But as I said, this is a bit artificial. That's in the spirit of a Monte Carlo calculation, where they put these heavy external charges and then do this for several spacings of the charges and look at the position where the string is breaking. We can also do real-time dynamics in the presence of dynamical charges. So we now do not violate this Gauss law anymore. We compute the interacting vacuum and then really apply a gauge invariant string operator. So the charges are now sitting in the system and are fully dynamical. And then we can do the same as we have done before. And what you see is, first of all, if you look at the charge square configuration, you see at the beginning here, always these two peaks, which have not been there before. That's due to the fact that the charges are now sitting in the system and are really dynamical. And then over time, you can once again see that the flux configuration for low masses is going away, whereas if you make it very massive, it's sitting there. But of course, the whole evolution is a lot less clean because the charges are now dynamical and can move around in the system. But there's clearly the sign that this flux region is going away. And some charges are produced here and spreading around the system. So we can do the same thing here. Look at the charge square configuration, the flux square configuration side resolved, and at the lengths or the histograms of strings. So the lower left one is for m equal 1, and you clearly see this peak around m equal 1. You also see nicely the peak in the charge square configuration for the charges which are now sitting in the system and which is going away and spreading over the system over time. And for the M equal 3 case, it's essentially the same. So they have this high flux region and the peak in the charges, which is then going away. And one can also identify the peak in these string histograms. Whereas if we make it very massive, so look at the lower right panel, we see that, I mean, it's not perfectly static due to the fact that we're basically doing a local crunch, but we see that the charges throughout the time we have looked at are preserved. And also in the string histogram, you can see that the peak around the L equal 11 string is preserved over time. So in that sense, it's not breaking, and we can, with our tools, identify both regimes and really learn something about the real-time dynamics which Monte Carlo would not give us. Okay, so now I would only like to briefly talk about certain projects we have done recently, because as I have said, what we have done before is this truncation of the gauge links, and this is computationally very challenging. Although we have used only the simplest non-trivial truncation, we had something which was five-dimensional, and if you want to go to larger values of Jmax, you see it scales horribly. So the idea is, can one do something better? And the question is probably yes, because in this reference on the lower right-hand side, people have realized that in the context of strong coupling expansion, so what happens if you start from a color-neutral state, since all terms in the Hamiltonian are color-neutral, you get this color-neutral superposition of states. So the idea these people in this reference basically had was to use this basis of color singlets instead of using the full basis and only work with gauge invariant quantities. So basically what they have figured out is a basis where the states can be characterized by the fermionic content and the J value on the link only, and one does not care about the Z components anymore. So here the left-hand side state would just be zero fermions, the J value is zero, and two fermions on the right-hand side, and one gets something on the right-hand side which has a single fermion on the left, a single fermion on the right, and a J one half in the middle. And what they have, I mean, the mass term and the electrostatic color electric energy are immediately diagonal in both bases, so that's relatively trivial. And in this reference, the vertex factors for the hopping element have been worked out. And this is, one can use this with MPS, and as I said, I'm always using open boundary conditions, so one can push this one step further, because Gauss' law in this formulation just reduces to the fact if the site is singly occupied, you have to change the color flux by one unit, either going up or going down. So one can basically start integrating out the gauge field. So if I know the value to the very left, I can reconstruct on every link the color electric field and therefore completely remove it. The only problem here in this formulation is that the case of a single fermion is ambiguous, because you could go up and down. And what we have done here is we have introduced two sublevels, one minus and one plus, to encode if the color electric flux is going up or going down. So basically what we can do is we can throw all the gauge links out and put four states on the fermionic sides and then reconstruct the entire SU2 theory. And what we have done here, which is still ongoing, is we have tried this basis and computed the mass spectrum from the theory for several truncations. So starting from the simplest non-trivial one and going up to Jmax of 2, which would be in the previous truncation procedure we've used already 55 dimensional. And as you can see, for the ground state, the relative deviation delta omega 0 in the energy to the exact value is very small. However, in the vector mass gap, one sees a drastic difference. So the Jmax 1/2 value is definitely not there, where these strong coupling results depicted as blue star from this reference here are coming, and shows that you need something higher dimensional here to really recover the right limit. And from that, we have also started extracting critical exponents from the vector mass gap. So these results here are still preliminary. And we also see that, like for 3/2 and 2, we are close to the analytic prediction in the in some reference by Steinhardt. But for these, we are really off. So this shows you also, if you would like to build a quantum simulator, the simplest non-trivial truncation is probably not enough to study vector mass gaps. Okay, so I would like to end here and give a short conclusion outlook. So I've basically studied these two models, the Schwinger model and the SU2 lattice gauge theory, and I hope that I could convince you that MPS are a very powerful tool to benchmark these kind of quantum simulators, because one can do real-time evolution and spectral calculations relatively straightforward. And I've also briefly shown you an example where MPS can use to overcome the sign problem in a gauge theory. And for the SU2 case, I have shown you that with MPS, we really get access to interesting novel problems like real-time dynamics of string breaking. And we also have the advantage that we can essentially access all kinds of local observables and therefore study different things which are also inaccessible to Monte Carlo simulations, like directly get the flux configuration. And I've only briefly mentioned that results we have that we're working on to find a more efficient basis formulation for all these calculations. And well, there's of course still something which can be done for these models. So the finite temperature phase structure for the two-flavor Schwinger model would be interesting because in the regime we have studied it, it's also only known for the zero mass case. There's phase structure at a finite background field for the two-flavor Schwinger model is also not directly known, and nobody has tried finite temperature calculations for SU2 lattice gauge theory with MPS yet. But of course, a major goal would also be to go to higher dimensions and hopefully at some point be able to compute 2+1 dimensional gauge theories with projected entangled pair states. And with this, I would like to thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, any questions?
Do you have questions?
Yeah?
Go ahead, teacher.
You should be able to speak. The mic's on the...
Speak about.
So when you mentioned the energy gap, how do you calculate the excited state energy?
So we basically just add a projector term to the Hamiltonian projecting out the ground state. So we have, unfortunately, I have nothing to write on. We just have the Hamiltonian minus the energy of the ground state and then a projector on psi 0, psi 0, and then you can run the same ground state or variational ground state calculation and calculate up to the state you would like to compute.
Thanks.
Stefan, I have another question.
Yeah.
So I always, every time I see a time evolution, simulation of time evolution, I'm very impressed. And in your case, you are doing even with a very complex structure of the local Hilbert space. But I want to ask you, did we learn something that, so exactly what did we learn that we could not learn directly by looking at the ground state, by a ground state of a Hamiltonian modified so that we would have a string? So I mean, dynamics of string breaking, sure, you see dynamics, but is there anything that we learn about the fact that there is breaking of a strings that we could not have learned directly by looking at different ground states where you enforce a string, you try to enforce a string of different lengths and see that for a short length, the ground state has a string?
Well, there's something which I haven't shown. So the, like as I said, in Monte Carlo, typically what one is doing, one is imposing these external charges and doing these calculations. And then what people are looking at is the Wilson loop. So they look if it has a perimeter law, and then they can figure out if one is in the string broken phase or not. So the Wilson loop is used to detect that. And this was numerically, for example, very problematic because people, what happens is that at a certain point when it's broken, the meson states mix in, and detecting this with a Wilson loop, although it's relatively easy to write down on paper, in practical numerics was very hard. And what we have, for example, done is imaginary time evolution. So we follow the energy as a function of imaginary time. And what we can see here immediately is how these meson states mix in. So unfortunately, I have nothing. Oh, I
can't. That's okay. So you're saying that you can see specific things
which was very hard in Monte Carlo simulations. So it took a long time to find out with Monte Carlo simulations. But in our system, we can basically follow this curve, see this metastable string state plateau, and then see another drop, which is when the meson states mix in and the state really, the string really breaks. And this is something which would be very heavy with conventional Monte Carlo sim. Or it took a very long time until people realized this is what's happening. And this is why one had problems in detecting string breaking with the Wilson loop so long.
Okay, all right, thank you.
Can we do it?
Okay, so thanks a lot again. No, sorry.
Mine actually.
Ash has a question, sorry.
I wanted to ask, in the beginning when you were talking about the Schwinger model, you showed a plot where you compared the truncated U1 with ZD results, and it looked like the ZD result was better. There was one plot where it was, yeah, there was the bottom right
one. This is the lower.
Yeah, I meant the lower left one, I guess, mainly, where you for the same D, you're getting a much better, what is that actually? What's in the plot? What's the y-axis?
So yellow is D equal 3, so the simplest non-trivial truncation, and blue is D equal 9, which means from minus 4 to plus 4 with
I see. So do you have an understanding as to why the ZD model is better than the truncated U1 model in this case?
Not really, I have to say. It's a bit surprising, but for some reason it's giving more consistent values. On the other hand, so if you look closely at the plot, we see that it's slightly converging, but it's converging to the Wilson limit much slower than the CQED model. But I don't have a deeper understanding why this happens.
And I wanted to ask, you mentioned at the end this for the SU2 gauge theory, that there's this color neutral basis. And then you talked about integrating out the gauge field. Now, I'm not sure I quite followed how related those two things were. Is this something you can do only in this basis, or can one plus one D? I think the gauge field is relatively easy to handle, right? I'm wondering partly about how this extends to higher dimensions.
Well, it doesn't extend to higher dimensions, but in one plus one D, the gauge field is basically not an independent degree of freedom.
Yeah.
But you read this very frequently, but I have never seen somebody really integrating it out in the Hamiltonian formulation like it has been done for the Schwinger model, where you can completely remove it if you put this long-range interaction. And for us, it is interesting because, as I have said, these calculations we have done are very challenging computationally. Even with the simplest non-trivial truncations, we have to take 2 fermions per site and 5 gauge links. 5-dimensional gauge links, so the computational cost grows very quickly. And with this basis I have presented, I have now shown you spectral calculations, but I have already played a bit around and tried time evolution calculations, and the basis basically allows you to do the entire same thing, but at a much smaller cost. So we can access much larger systems at lower computational cost, and potentially, I haven't tried it yet, but this might maybe also extend to SU3. It's much more complicated to compute these vertex factors, but this might be maybe an idea how one could go in this direction.
Okay.
So that's why it is interesting for us and why we try to do that.
Okay. Good. Thank you. Let me just check. Do I have anything else? Oh, yeah. I also wanted to ask, when you talk about the Schwinger model quantum simulators in the beginning, I just out of interest, I haven't really thought about it very much, but are there any sort of natural rotor systems that one could consider exploiting for such simulations, or is it really a matter of using bosons or momentum degrees of freedom, something like you mentioned?
I'm not really an expert on this quantum optics side of really constructing these Hamiltonians, but I'm not aware of any proposals which directly use rotors. So typically it's some superconducting qubits, some atomic setup, the decomposition of the links in left and right electric field, and writing them as Rishons or something like that. So I haven't seen something with a rotor where you would get rid of this truncation problem somehow.
Welcome. Okay.